How was Grow Ruck?
Grow Ruck was everything it was advertised to be. It was physically, emotionally, and mentally challenging for all who participated.
Excellent. That's what it's supposed to do, right?
Amongst other things, it's supposed to challenge. It's also supposed to build teamwork and
delivered.
Eliminate barriers that men construct. So it's supposed to help those
right.
Get barriers those be eliminated.
Mental in particular.
I guess mental, emotional.
Yeah.
Physical,
yeah,
I would think they should
I would hope,
maintain
right?
But the barriers. But again, I know we've been through this many times. I'm not judging.
Just here to observe and criticize.
That's all. That's all.
How did Slaughter do?
Slaughter failed the Glow Ruck. Dark Helmet just had Nestle brand water come right out of his
that almost
his large Western Virginia noggin.
It's like some sort of Macy's Day Parade balloon fountain. Almost happened there.
Yeah, it was horrible. But no, he didn't really fail. He lived up to expectations. He
good.
Actually exceeded them. Slaughter was a stalwart. He's a yeoman.
He's a yeoman.
He spent the night as a yeoman.
That's good.
Yeah, he's certainly.
That's good.
It's
where he belongs.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
Was.
I feel like I haven't seen you in forever.
It's been 2 weeks.
I know. I don't like that.
In the ensuing, in the intervening two weeks, you took a trip to Naperville.
I did.
They like you in Naperville for some reason.
You know what it is, and I found that most people that really kind of develop an affinity for me and like me have very little frame of reference
or low standards or are
a little of both
handicapped in some way.
Something.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Generally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it about time that you roll the opening credits?
Somewhere
go.
Here, yeah.
Go.
You're listening to 43 Feet, a podcast about leadership. We believe that real leading happens out front, but that means you're probably building the next 43 feet of good road for those behind you while you're running the race yourself. My name is Frank Schwartz, known in the gloom of the early morning as Dark Helmet to my F3 brothers. And I'm joined each week by Dave Redding, or Dredd, one of the co-founders of F3 Nation. We're going to answer your questions, pontificate wildly, teach leadership, and otherwise attempt to help you navigate the next 43 feet.
And hey, we're back. We're back. We're ready.
I don't know why that's my favorite joke, but it's good.
We're ready to pontificate wildly.
That's right. That's right. Well, the carrier pigeons brought us something to talk about this week.
You know, we missed a week. I just wanted to ask before we launch.
Yeah, by all means.
Did anyone say to you, hey, I'd like to see some 43?
Yeah, there were guys going. Well, I saw a few tweets, and then a number of guys directly reached out and said, hey, what gives? And I said, well, I tweeted. And they're like, well, you need to tweet more because we didn't see it.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I think mostly they missed you. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. I mean.
We're just going to, anything to add more smugness to that smirk is going to, it's good. Yeah, we got it. And we're back. This episode of 43 Feet is brought to you by, actually, we don't have one this week.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I guess we could mention the basin run again, but it's
no,
that's
one
not
time
official.
Deal.
That's over. Sorry, fellas. So the question I have for you to start things off this week, if we're kind of staying in our live right quadrant, and we talked a little bit about impact a couple of weeks ago, but underneath that is a principle, the Q2.2, right, of influence. And I see it a lot. I still see it even in amongst our guys even. But the temptation toward governance is very strong.
The temptation to be part of governance.
To be part of governance.
Oh, right.
To influence in the way of, like, as governance would.
In other words,
sticks.
By virtue of becoming elected or pointed to the controlling apparatus of an organization.
Yeah, and then to...
Formal leadership is what you mean.
Formal leadership is where they feel most comfortable.
Sure.
And then the techniques and methods, tactics that
formal governance would use often. So sticks maybe rather than carrots.
Well, coercion.
Tends to be the method of choice right. still. So I guess question number one, if we back up and kind of say, help me understand influence a little bit. And then I really want to talk about how do you avoid coercion? Because sometimes you want to move fast. And the fastest way to get something done is to, punch a guy until he does it, I guess,
sure.
or something.
Right, right.
So how do you manage that?
Well, your first question was, what is influence?
For the listening audience.
For the listening audience. Well, influence, the Cube 2.2 is defined as igniting a palpable desire for movement. So igniting, of course, that invokes the image of lighting a flame of some kind. Palpable means you can feel it, you can touch it. Desire is self-explanatory. You want to do something. Mm-hmm. So that palpable desire, something you feel that you want. And then movement is the sense of departure from the status quo towards something advantageous for the individual or the organization. So the man who influences as a part of impact, the man who's living right, is doing that in his concentric and maybe a little beyond that, igniting a palpable desire for movement. Though when I say that, I want to say not much far that are beyond his concentric. I mean, if you think about
it. He's not trying to influence the world.
No.
It's not proximate enough.
Right. It's funny, I was waiting for you out in the parking lot just now, and I was looking at my Facebook page, and a lot of it was about what's going on with the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people I know and I'm friends with on Facebook are writing all these heartfelt things one way or the other about the pending outcome of this vote to confirm or not confirm an associate justice of the United States Supreme Court. And I thought, I saw a lot of these opinions on there, and I thought, well, I mean, you have not very many people will find themselves arguing before the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right.
I unlikely will not, right. despite the
and,
fact
and
that
you're saying you have a better chance than
I
most
I have a better
of
chance than most. I was at the Fourth Circuit this week, which is one level down, but that case ain't going to the Supreme Court. And I probably never will. And to be honest with you, I don't care that much.
Yeah, that's not necessarily interesting.
But, you look at your Facebook page and folks really care who the next associate justice of the Supreme Court is. It's amazing to me.
Has that the way it's always been, or am I just noticing it now that everybody seems?
I find it hard to believe.
That it's always been that way?
Yeah.
That we get super upset and super worked up and super concerned about these things that really have very little, if any, bearing on our
day-to-day lives.
Well,
yeah, I got a theory, of course, is why I set it up this way. I think the more frustrated you are in your efforts to influence those in your concentric, the more likely it is that you can shout out to the world about something you can't influence anyway. I mean, no offense to people that are posting all this stuff. I'm like, I don't think people are listening.
Well, no.
They may be yelling back at you.
Right, but only I think that only means that you're yelling will bump into each other.
Right.
It's not even that
right.
they necessarily intend to influence you.
Right. I mean, there's 100 senators.
Yeah.
They're the only ones who get a vote.
I'm not one of them.
You can yell at them, and I guess maybe it works. I don't know. Maybe people actually drive to Washington and take the time to yell at one of these guys
sure.
or gals.
Or send them emails.
I guess maybe it works, but
tweet
or send them emails.
Something.
I don't know. But I guess I'd say to you, not you, but one of these people, why do you care more about that than you do about the people in your concentrica?
Mm-hmm.
Not really sure I understand it.
Yeah.
Quite frankly.
I'm ignoring my kids, but by golly.
And, to be fair, they may not be. They may also be great parents and all that, and this is kind of a side hustle for them. But since it's my business, I mean, I'm a lawyer,
sure.
right? I have a reason to care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why your average, but put your bigger candlestick maker cares. But anyway, that's kind of my point is if you focus your energy on being influential, looking around you at the targets of people that you might ignite, in whom you might ignite a palpable desire for action, it's a pretty short list.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'd ask myself, am I doing it before I thought of wandering off to the Twitterverse and see if I can influence people to think differently about a group of people that we'll never know.
It's kind of that, is that kind of a mote beam, kind of a splinter beam kind of a thing? Get the splinter out of your own eye kind of a thing?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm not calling anybody a hypocrite.
No, I didn't mean, okay, that's fair.
That's how I take that passage
yeah, yeah,
of the
no,
Bible,
yeah,
right?
That makes sense. Yeah.
And if for those of you in the podcast world listening to that, what I think what Darkest of All Helmets is referring to is Christ counseling people that are critical of other people to to not ignore the fact that they have a speck in their own eye. So don't or a plank rather. So you know the depending on the version of the Bible, you're worried about a speck in another man's eye and not and ignoring the plank in
the
your
plank
own
in,
eye.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's less that than lacking the skill and the commitment to influence people that are actually right there around you. Influence your own kids. Influence the guys in your shield lock, right? Influence at work. Instead of doing that, because you're frustrated by that or you're not having any progress, standing on a mountaintop yelling out into the wind. Because that's
so
really that all
makes
that
you
is.
Feel like you're doing something.
Makes
more.
You feel like you're doing something.
Yeah. See, and so maybe taking it to say that someone is a hypocrite, maybe that is too far, but I don't know.
Sure.
I mean,
if you want to yell at a Supreme Court justice, I'm afraid you have to go to law school first, you know, and then work
or find him after.
Like, you know, and I went to law school and I spent a lot of years becoming a lawyer and all that stuff. And I got to argue this week and three judges had to listen to me, but they yelled at me more than I yelled at them. I mean, not sure I influenced them, right? In fact, yelling at them wouldn't work because I need to persuade them, which would be your next point is you're not going to persuade anybody.
By yelling
at them. If you want to influence, if you want to ignite a palpable desire for movement in the heart of another man, yelling at him isn't going to work. Questioning his integrity, telling him he's stupid, just not going to work.
Not going to work. Enforcing some kind of punishment.
Well, that might work. I mean, you might get short-term compliance by doing that. You know, and we talk about this in persuasion, which is later on in the third quadrant, but compulsive chicanery, you know, compelling people and lying to them, which is kind of what most governance does.
Mm-hmm.
The compulsion part, you might be able to compel somebody to do something while you have the power over them, but as soon as he shakes off the yoke of it that guarantees his compliance, he's going to turn on you. Now, chicanery, you may lie to a guy for a while, but when he learns the truth, you'll never, ever get him to listen to you
again. It's over, yeah.
So compulsive chicanery, to me, is a non-starter. I mean, it's influence, right?
Sure, but in the same way that pushing somebody down some steps is influence
or
something. Yeah.
Well, I know that's not influence by my definition. I mean, that's not igniting a palpable desire, right? I mean, you're not influencing anybody ever by compelling them. What you've done is remove their choices. And they'll go the one. So if a guy has five choices and you want him to go down path number three and you remove the other four choices so that he has no hope but to avoid pain that you're inflicting to go down that third path, you haven't influenced him. You haven't ignited a palpable desire for movement. What you've done is torture him into doing it. You've compelled him into doing it. And as soon as you are no longer able to apply that flame, he's not going to move anymore.
Yeah.
In fact, most of his energy will be used to free himself from the yoke of your tyranny. That's how revolutions happen. So, yeah, I'd say that's not influence.
So if impact is forcible contact.
To strong effect, right?
Right. And influence then is, I guess, how we do that to ignite. Rather
it's
than
one
to
of the ways.
Compel.
Right.
Right. A way.
Right. Well, it's one of the five components of impact.
Right.
So influencing, right, and being missional and positive habit transfer, blah, right.
Yeah. Right. Well, and we're going to get to some of those.
Were you going to ask me, where's the forcible part come in?
Sure.
So the forcible part is not that you force someone, it's that you force contact, proximity. Right. It's not that I come to you and force you to move in a direction, it's that I close the distance between the two of us. To obtain proximity, somehow I build a relationship first. That's the forcible contact. And the reason we use that phrase, forcible contact, is because it's not just going to happen. You know, an open door policy doesn't get you very far. You've kind of got to get
people to talk to you. You've got to open it and get out there.
Well, you've got
give them a reason to.
Open door policy is great if you're using it to walk out of your own office. But if you mean it to say, well, I'll wait till other people walk in here so I can influence them, it's not likely to happen because people cling to the status quo. Yeah, right. So the forcible contact. Part is to seek the contact, seek the proximity you're going to need to be influential.
So with the open door policy, with the screaming into the Twitter sphere, all those kinds of things, is that us, not us, you and I, but the
greater
royal,
us,
the royal us,
yeah,
if you will. Is that are we sloughing off our responsibility to do something?
Avoiding, if that's what you
avoiding.
Mean.
Okay.
Sure. But I guess I would
thinking more of an actual,
I guess I would take away responsibility, because to me responsibility is accepted. So I would take issue with the idea that we are born with a responsibility.
What are we born with then?
Many things, but not a responsibility, not an obligation to anything.
Okay.
You have to accept an obligation. So you when I accept a client as a client, I accept a responsibility for the outcome of his legal issue. I accept that.
Right.
And until I do, the attorney-client privilege does not evoke, and I'm not responsible for that person.
So then what is it in a man that makes him want to have impact and want to influence and want to do
this? Oh, we're hardwired for that. It's hardwired.
Okay, but that's what I'm trying to get at then is
it's innate. But when I think of the terms of responsibility, I think very much in terms of leadership. You know, we define Q as someone who is responsible for the outcome.
Right.
And you have to agree to be the leader. I guess I would say this. If you don't agree to be a leader and decide to do so, then you're not responsible for the outcome in the community you live in the organizations of which you are a member, in the teams of which you are a member. You're not.
Okay.
Not until you accept it.
Right. I'm doing this.
Now, you may be obligated in a sense to not harm anyone.
Okay.
Or to...
But if it's innate, then it's not a responsibility? So what is the... It's just an innate desire?
Yeah, it's a motivation.
It's a thing that pushes us.
Sure.
Okay.
And not everyone has it to the same degree. I mean, there's...
Clearly.
I would say probably the minority of men are willing to accept the responsibility goes with leadership.
Why?
They're much more willing to accept what they perceive as the advantages of being in the governance.
Yes.
The corner office.
Which is
kind of
where I was starting. Right. Yeah.
What they learn if they actually accept the responsibility to be a leader is there's many more burdens than there are benefits from leadership.
If you're doing it virtuously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
It ain't easy being the man.
No. So innately, then I want to influence men. I want to help others to achieve advantage.
Yes, to move towards advantage for themselves.
Right. Okay.
To depart the status quo and to achieve a superior position. That's what advantage is.
And so maybe this is a personal question to kind of a, well, how do you do it? But maybe it's more of a general question of how does a man do it? But you run up against guys who don't want to be influenced. They want to remain in the status quo.
Well,
do you just ignore those guys, or do you try and influence them?
Cy Wakeman has a great line where she says she only works with the willing.
Okay.
And I've adopted that. She's exactly right. So if I really believe that a man really wants to stay in the status quo, then I'm not going to...
Skip him.
Well, skip him. I mean, I'm not going to inflict myself on him.
Sure.
You know, if I really believe it, have encountered very few men like that.
What if he's causing problems?
Oh, he's toxic?
Yeah, he's causing the problems.
By problem, do you mean something adverse that must be fixed, can and must be fixed, or do you mean a condition?
That's reasonable. I guess can and must, I guess I know the answer to that. But it would be advantageous if we fixed it.
Well, maybe, but then within problems. So maybe we got to back up and do some redefinition.
Okay.
You know, a condition is something adverse, unwanted, that cannot or must not be fixed. And that's something you learn to live in, learn to live with. That's a condition.
Like an example?
The weather.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
When it's raining out, as it was for those of you in Memphis and Grow Ruck, a little shout out to Memphis. Go, Memphis. It rained a lot. It rained a lot.
Yeah.
In fact, about 5-ish a.m., we were in some park, a veterans park. It was interesting. It had a lot of statues and statuary, and we were getting ready to make the march back to the start point, which was 5 miles. You know, we were tired, beat up pretty good, and right at that moment, we're getting ready to go back. Guys, emotions were starting to peak a little bit. We're feeling pretty good, and it started to rain like crazy. I mean, just cats and dogs, you know? right?
Yeah.
So that was...
It was perfect.
It was just perfect, right? Yeah, yeah, it was just perfect. So that was not a problem.
Right. Right? Okay, because you can't...
Because there's nothing to do to solve it.
Yeah.
Right? It was a condition.
It is what it is.
It is what it was, right?
As the kids say.
So that's to one of the many John Foxisms that to which I subscribe. It is what it is.
Yeah.
So that's a condition. Now, a problem is different than a condition in that not only can it be solved, but it must be solved, right? It is an obstacle that has to be removed to achieve advantage. And within that are two types. One would be a deck chair, which is a fairly minor problem. And another one would be an iceberg, which is Conchilia,
slightly larger.
I'd start in an organization of which I'm a leader. I'm going to start with the icebergs.
Yeah.
Now, while you're working on the icebergs, people are going to come to you with deck chairs, and you need to find a nice way to have them prioritize those, because you're the leader and you're responsible for the outcome. So you're the one who has to make that.
Would
call.
You just tell them right at the front, as you come into leadership, you would say, "Now, gentlemen, ladies, as we go down this path, there's going to be icebergs. There's going to be deck chairs, and I'm going to." Deal with icebergs first, and if you come to me with deck chairs, don't be offended if I say, hey, we're going to hold on to the deck chair because we're dealing with icebergs.
I would tell my shared leadership team that.
Okay.
I might not tell the greater membership of the organization because that's not information that they need or are ready to hear, perhaps.
Fair.
But if my shared leadership team, those with whom we're combining for influence, if as long as they know that's clear, that has to be the leadership philosophy. To be effective, we need to prioritize these things. And once we're done with the icebergs, then we'll start worrying about those deck chairs.
Mm-hmm.
But we're never going to do anything about the conditions because
can't do anything about it. Yeah, they're external to the point where
there's no
reason or ability to influence them.
Well, you will
make
it get
an umbrella.
You'll expend valuable resources trying to. An umbrella to me is not a solution to a rainstorm. Right.
Fair.
It's an ameliorating condition. Right.
Yeah.
So I might say, well, I'm cold. I'll put on a jacket. Doesn't change the weather, does it?
Weather's still doing its thing.
To me, that's survivability. That's a way to adapt to it. So if somebody says to me, what are we going to do about the rain? I'll be like, well, I guess put up an umbrella, get wet or learn to live with it. There's many things you could do to learn how to survive it, but there's nothing you can do to learn how to change it.
The Hopi had a certain dance that they...
Sure.
But no.
And I would encourage anyone who's insisted upon doing so to do a similar dance.
Sure.
If they think it'll help. I probably won't participate unless you compel me. See, I came back around.
There we are.
That's right. So when you... I think to try to bring this back around, a toxic in an organization, to me... if it's someone who can and must be fixed, I guess I would try if I had to. But within a community, for instance, in which it has no purpose, and it's just people who voluntarily choose to live together, as long as you're obeying the law and generally the mores of the community, I'm not going to. And you insist upon being who you are, my response is you be you. You be you. I mean, I don't have any reason to try to change.
You want to trim those hedges into cones?
Whatever,
brother, doesn't matter to me.
Whatever works for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
As long as it doesn't violate the law and the general mores of the community, I see no need to take any action, which, takes us kind of the first spur of influence, which is that movement must be voluntary.
Mm.
It has to be that. If someone can't or won't move, or won't initiate a movement in their own life. A lot of guys are tempted to compel it, right?
But that's what I was wondering about. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just not the way. That's not the way it works. We use persuasion. And that's initiation of first movement.
Yeah.
Right.
And we probably could spend a whole, and maybe we will at some point, a whole 43 talking about persuasion.
I'd like to have a podcast about persuasion.
The whole thing.
I mean, just like
not one episode, but like a whole year of persuasion.
Persuasion to me is one of the rare skills of a truly virtuous leader, and it's really rare. And which is why compulsive chicanery is resorted to so often, is because most people cannot persuade. They don't know how to do it. They've never been trained to do it.
And you always come back to this, which I think actually probably speaks to who you are. To some degree too, but because I tend to go, well, they do that, these people, they don't, they use compulsive chicanery because they're jerks, But you're saying really just a lack of skill.
Yeah, unskilled.
People don't want to do this necessarily. They just really don't know another choice to use.
Well, when I'm confronted with someone who is not skillful as a leader, I want to make all the positive assumptions I can about that person. And so instead of assuming they're a bully or a jerk, first I want to assume that they're relying upon the only tool in their box. Right? So where they should be using a Phillips head screwdriver, they're using a hammer. And it's not because they choose to use a hammer and leave the Phillips head screwdriver. They just don't have one. And no one
has ever shown them that this is a thing and how to use it or
No one's ever even suggested it to them. They don't know how to do it. And, you know, this is Leave-Right, but they've never had the schooling, they've never had the apprenticeship, they've never had the opportunity or the failure to do so. So they haven't learned that skill. It's a learned skill. And persuasion is hard to learn over the years. It's particularly hard to learn when no one even suggests it to you. Right?
I didn't know it existed. Sure. Well, then why didn't you do it?
How could I?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and that second spur of influences that movement is a release of energy.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
Well, it's kind of like a dam, right?
Mm-hmm.
The dam, what's being held back, what's impounded, so a dam impounds water, that's the engineering phrase for it. What's being held back, the water, is that desire in men to move. They want to move. Like, just as the water wants to go downstream, but the dam holds it back.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do as a influencer is you help the man open the sluice and let the water flow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a release of energy. That's another reason why it has to be voluntary. You know, you can't force the water out, can't break the dam, you know, or you're going to have
some disaster. You got a real problem, yeah.
You got a real problem. So that's pretty important.
So not to dwell too much backwards into persuasion, but I've got a team at work, or I've got, my kids or whomever it may be, right? And I don't want to, I'm going to believe your premise, which I think is probably true, that I don't want to exercise compulsion, right, or coercion.
Right.
I don't want to do that.
Right.
I want to influence. I want to gently persuade.
Right. Well, I never said gently.
Okay.
I don't think I said gently.
No, you didn't. I said it. I inserted that one myself.
I just point that out. All right.
So, okay. Well, then if it's not gentle, then what is it?
Zealous.
Okay.
Zealous. I find it hard to believe that I could be persuaded by someone who wasn't zealous, committed, passionate.
I guess that when I say gently, I'm thinking nice versus being mean and yelling and screaming and throwing things or whatever it might be to get you to do something.
Yeah, you set some binary choices up for me that I'm difficult with. I mean,
I'm
not much of a yeller.
Right.
But I don't think I leave much doubt about what I think is good from bad.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see that as gentle, necessarily.
I don't think I'm gentle.
I don't either. But that's a. I've been on the receiving
end. You've begged me to be. Sorry. Well, you know, I guess if I'm going to go through the
and that's a really good point. And I have a bad tendency to do that, to be a little too binary, just in general, I think. And I don't know if that's a common trait amongst men, or if that's just me, or what. But when I set it up, I tend to think that way sometimes.
Well,
it's either gentle or it's hard, and that's the only two options or something.
You know, a guy wrote a thing on Facebook about my idiot leadership style in Memphis this weekend. It's funny, just completely nailed me. He said he started out thinking I was a complete asshole, and ended up ultimately listening to what I was saying. Mainly because of the way I went about it. You know, like I would draw guys out, challenge them, encourage them if they failed, keep encouraging them, but, you know, leave them with that feeling that I cared about them, I cared about their progress. And really, I'm just flipping around what I need there. I'm not really going to listen to a gentle approach. If you tell me gently, then I'm in a wrong spot. I kind of need to hear it
forcefully.
With a little zeal.
With a little zeal.
Yeah, I need a little zeal. Like, you really mean it, right?
Sprinkle some zeal on it.
Yeah, I mean, so...
Okay.
And not... I'm not saying everybody should use the same premise, but that's the way I was influenced, you know, and I go back to the men who were influential in my life, and I guess I've kind of adopted the way they are. I mean, and they share some characteristics, different kind of men in different kind of places, but the first one is that they were different. You know, they always stood out. Not from each other so much, but the other members of the organization, you know. They were unwilling to go along with the status quo. That was the main thing, right?
So, in hearkening back to previous episodes, that West Memphis somebody,
right? Exactly. I mean, he was different.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't go along with the status quo, the kind of the givens.
Right. This is the way we do things.
He was willing, you know, he was willing to stand out, to be disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And all the men who have influenced me have been that way. They were disruptive in some way. Something they did, you know, like the West Memphis somebody. Stop me if I've already told the story and you can recall it, but first time I showed up, I was very tired and I fell asleep.
I don't remember that.
I don't know.
I
fell asleep in another guy's office in the unit, and I was waiting, and suddenly this guy... I hear this guy saying, you know, I had my feet up on this kind of desk or this, it was like a low table something. Yeah, I was asleep.
End table sort of thing, yeah.
And this guy wakes me up and he says, you know, can I ask you why you have your feet on my furniture? Would you mind if I asked you that? And I looked up and I like bleary-eyed, and I saw him. He's a captain, so he outranked me. I just didn't know who I was. Didn't know I hadn't met him before. And I said, I'm sorry. And he said, I already know you're sorry. Question was, I asked you why you have your feet on my furniture.
Yeah.
And I started blabbering, and he said, well, the first thing you need to do is get them the hell off. Because I still have them.
Because you're still up?
So that was my first introduction to him.
Uh-huh.
You know.
That's different.
He got my attention, right? Yeah. He was disruptive. Now, later on, I found out that this part of his shtick, right? You know, that's just kind of the way he approached people,
but it was with the intent to influence.
That's why
he approached.
He was gonna influence by word.
Because he could have just come in and yelled and screamed at you and said, "Get your blankety blank feet off my blankety blank," whatever.
Yeah, well, a high impact man influences through word and deed. It's the things he says and the way he says them, and the things he does and the way he does them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just the way it goes, right?
Yeah.
But he got my attention in that way, and so is every other leader that had a lot of impact on me. You know, number one is they stood out. You know, they were disruptive, wanted to be disruptive in some way, accepted that, and the consequences of being disruptive. Not everyone's going to like you. Certainly not everyone's going to like you at first. Most people are very, very comfortable with the status quo. You come in there and you shake it up, man.
You're not going to make a lot of friends right out of the gate.
It's not usually. Second, the words of all these guys were always clear and uncompromising. You know, they did not say we when they meant I. Right?
Mm.
You know,
yeah, that's one that I do a lot.
Yeah, a lot of
just
lot
to soften. To soften.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a way of avoiding responsibility.
Hmm.
You know, we here at LEC. You know, believe
yeah,
this.
We feel
well, you're
these
the
things.
Boss, right?
I feel this.
I feel these things, right?
Yeah.
So that's one way. Another one is passive voice. Oh, mistakes were made instead of I made a mistake. Right. Or, you know, we can all agree that mistakes were made. In fact, it's you that made the mistake.
I know, that's right.
You know, and if I don't tell you that, you'll join me in this kind of soft, gentle misbelief, misapprehension that you are responsible for what wrong, or I am responsible for what.
Whatever it may be, but we never get to the truth.
Right. We never get to the truth. What I found out as I would get to know these guys, you know, that the reason why their words were so uncompromising was because they themselves were not compromised men. You know, compromised men speak that way.
What does it mean to be a compromised man?
That you are not living right in some
okay.
way. You are hiding who you are because you're ashamed of it. You know you're not measuring up. And because of that, you speak in a compromising manner because you have compromised yourself. And the high impact men that had influence on me. First, they're disruptive. Second, I always understood what they were saying.
Never.
There was no doubt about what they were saying. And then as I got to know them, it was because they were not compromised. They had not given in to something in the culture or the organization around them that left them incapable of applying high-impact leadership. And their words rung out.
Reflected that, yeah.
Yeah, reflected that.
There is no mascotry to be found.
That's right.
Hmm.
The third thing is their deeds were unselfish.
Yeah.
You know, the things they did were generally for the organization. I'm not saying they were, saints and they martyred themselves. I'm just saying.
Complete altruism all the time, no matter what.
No one is. But for the most part, they would be men that if they were taking action, that action was for the advantage of the organization first and for themselves second. And oftentimes what they were doing would put themselves at disadvantage personally. They were taking on the short end of the stick.
In order to push advantage for others.
Influence.
Yeah.
They were leading, they were leading the way in that way. And I've tried to emulate that. That's why I do the GORUCK.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Ranger tab. I'm a Green Beret. I could be a GORUCK cadre.
Mm.
I don't have to get under the line.
Yeah.
But I don't think that would lead to long-term advantage for the organization. And before you think that I'm like Mr. Self-sacrificial hero or something, I hate doing that.
And it shows it in
hurts.
Your face every
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I'm tired, yeah. man. I'm tired, yeah. right? I would much rather not get under the log, but I don't believe that it would be to the long-term advantage of the organization. It certainly would be to my short-term advantage.
Sure.
Oh,
yeah.
But not to the long-term advantage of the organization. And what I learned from these men who influenced me was that's what you had to do. If you wanted other men to take the first bite of the dog crab or take the bite of the dog crab sandwich, you had to take the first bite.
You got
to
do it, yeah.
You had to take that first bite. You had to be there. You had to be there first, and you had to be there and stay last. And that's just the way it was. And that final thing we already talked about was that they approached problem solving like pros rather than amateurs. For them, an undesirable circumstance was only a problem if it created a group disadvantage that could and must be remedied, like we just said. They were always like that.
An actual problem, right. Not a circumstance.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They didn't go rolling around saying, we got to fix these conditions. They're unfavorable to the group, so we're going to throw ourselves into fixing them, nor did they waste valuable resources on, the little pea problems, on the deck chairs. They just didn't do that.
They just accepted what was there and then moved forward to change those things, which could be changed, which could be influenced.
And must be.
And
must be. They can be and they must be.
How do you know?
That's leadership, baby.
Ah.
Sucker? Yeah, sorry. Walked into that. That's where the vision parts come in, and that only comes from experience, what you get through opportunity.
Yeah.
I made up and still make a lot of mistakes misdiagnosing problems. Sometimes I see a condition I think is a problem. Sometimes I see a problem and think it's a condition. That's kind of how I am. In fact, I just was talking to one of my young lawyers just now, and he was trying to encourage me to take a video deposition instead of just a regular deposition without a video.
Mm-hmm.
And I was against it, and we're talking about why. And I said, but I'll admit something to you, is that I have a tendency, a bias towards simplicity. So the fact that I would have to deal with the videographer and you're in the middle of your deposition as the videographer, if he runs out of tape, we'll say, well, I have to change tape, and it bugs me. Plus, I know at trial, client having paid for the video is going to want me to use it, even if it's not usable.
Even if it's not advantageous.
It's like, what about that video I paid for? And then I'd end up using it for some dumb purpose, because the client wants me to.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm leaning, my bias is towards simplicity. I said, that's why I set my mind, try to be open. Persuade me, convince me that in this circumstance, that would be to our advantage, to the client's advantage, to take a video deposition. In other words, the guy's going to die. He's in another jurisdiction. I can't subject him to a subpoena. Or I think he's going to, blow up.
Something,
and, and throw some kind of crazy tirade that I want to get
right,
on
Right, and you want to see that.
Yeah, I want to get it on video. I said, short of all that, it's not worth it. But I try to open my mind to it, knowing that I have this bias. This as a small P, and it's actually a big P. And because, he's in my shared leadership team, I'd listened to him, and then ultimately said, "You're crazy, get out of my office." No, I mean, I listened to him and made the decision.
Get your feet off my furniture.
But based on experience, now he doesn't have as much experience as me, and he doesn't know some of the things I just said from experience. He doesn't know that it's difficult when you're putting on a case in a trial. It's difficult for some practical reasons to get a video going.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it depends what court you're in. Did they have it? I mean, it's just video. Well, you're a video guy, you know.
Yeah, I would say it always works until you get in there, and then somehow it breaks down when
you're a pro, and we're amateurs as lawyers. Every time that I've seen it work, three times the lawyer pushes the button and it just
sits. At least
that
many.
Right.
At least
that many. Or it goes to a place in the video where he didn't want to be.
Right.
Or it goes to something else he's got loaded on there he didn't really see. I mean, there's a million things, right?
You shouldn't reuse those tapes.
Yeah, better off not doing it, right?
Yeah.
Unless you can make it perfect. Or it's such a big case that not only do you take the video, but you've got a guy you can hire at trial to run it for you.
Yeah.
That way you're not trying to spin plates
that are not yours to spin.
Too far apart from each other to keep them going. So, you know, that's what comes from experience, right? So you take all those four things together and you know what kind of man we're talking about. It's the kind of man who's going to cast a light if it's possible and necessary, but he's not going to curse the darkness if it isn't.
Yeah.
Right? That's influence. And that comes from leading a lot, failing a lot, and learning the best way you influence men and going with that.
And that's something that I am hopeful that guys hear and adhere to and understand as we go through this, because some people have, I think, looked at what we're doing here on the 43 and are saying, "Oh, this is the dread manual for life," and it's not.
Better not be.
Trust me, you don't want to turn out like this guy.
No.
But it's you got to listen past the practical things, even though those things are good. And I notice that you skillfully avoid too many questions if I try to get too direct about what would you do. And I don't know if that's intentional or not, but you would rather talk about the principle.
Yeah, it's about principle. It's not a recipe.
Well, that's what I was saying, so that people can understand that there's a principle here, and you have to find what works for you. And the only way you're going to find what works for you is by screwing it up a lot,
right?
And by banging into stuff, and then getting more skillful and more skillful over time.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Because that's, and I have a bad tendency to do this. I don't know if it's true of other guys. I think it is because I hear it some, but where, you know, you kind of go, "Man, I just don't have it all figured out." So and then the temptation to just sort of throw it all down and go, "Forget it. It's not worth it."
There's nothing wrong with trying to be like somebody you admire for a while.
Sure.
You know, I tried to lead like Patton for a while, you know. It didn't work.
Slightly different circumstances.
But what you find is when you put on another leader's kind of armor, whatever, or costume, whatever, and try it out for a while.
Doesn't fit.
You know, you may end up taking 95% off, but leaving the goggles. Goggles did work, right?
So you'll hang on to those.
Whatever, you know, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're a young leader, you don't really have any other choice. You're going to be heavily influenced by the leaders that you find yourself being apprenticed by. They're going to influence you.
Yeah.
Their style, the things that work for them, you're going to try those things and try them, and one will work and one won't, and do that, you know? You know, for me, for instance, I've always tried to really use humor a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that works for me. I didn't do that at first because it distracted me and I couldn't, you know, I was trying to figure things out.
I wasn't skillful at it.
But after a while, you know, I found that I could do it. If you try to use it right out of the chute, you know, you have trouble getting respect to your men, that kind of thing. You gotta pick your moments, know when to do it.
Yeah.
And that's a matter of feel, right? Which you only gain over time.
So is it well? I'm gonna have to save that for another day because
as you are usually quick to point out about yourself, Frank.
What's that?
You do not have a face for radio. No. Wait a second.
Wait,
I screwed up. Leave this in because it's a good example.
It's a good example
because I got myself all backwards. I say, Frank.
Yes.
You got a face for the television. Oh, I did it again. I got it backwards twice. All right. Here's why, because they keep coming at you with Frank.
There's
Dark Helmet.
Yes, Dredd.
You got a face for radio.
Oh, Dredd. This is a podcast.
Boom.
It's hard to rely on my good intentions when my head's full of things that I can't mention.
Thanks for listening to 43 Feet, a leadership podcast. If you have questions about leadership, F3, or anything else, write us at questions at 43feetpodcast.com. Tweet us at 43 Feet Podcast, or send a carrier pigeon to 43 Feet, 1415 South Church Street, Suite B, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28203. Until next time, we'll be here in the unknown, the uncomfortable, the difficult, the 43 Feet out front. This little